sectionalism and secession, which I've said numerous times, is essentially the 1850s. And we've gotten a really nice start on this because we got the Compromise of 1850 out of the way. And I'll mention that later on. Don't forget this concept of sectionalism. It starts pretty much day one. Remember when we identified the New England, the Middle, and the Southern colonies? And I mentioned sectionalism at that time, and I told you that that's going to hang with us forever. It's still with us today, right? We here in South Dakota, when we hear news out there about Wyoming, Nebraska, Montana, our ears perk up a little bit more than when we hear news about something going on in Arkansas or Nevada. Well, that's just because of sectionalism. Sectionalism can be good for the moment. It can be bad for the moment, like a lot of elements of history, and it can just be for the moment. So you have to consider it in the moment. And it stays with us, but you know, and peaks and valleys. So there's going to be moments in history where it's going to be tough to find anything significant that we can relate to sectionalism. And then there's going to be other times in history where there's a huge issue that it is based on sectionalism. And then, don't forget states' rights. Now, here's where we are with states' rights. You think you've got it all. I'm going to add something here. And I've introduced this concept to you in bits and pieces. And if we just would have stopped where I first introduced it to you, it wouldn't have been enough. And I didn't tell you that at the time because I didn't want to, you know, create some issues. But here's where we are. So, when I first introduced states' rights to you, I did it from a pretty basic point. I said it was the concept that a state could simply refuse to follow a federal law just because that state didn't care for it. The Kentucky, for example, did not feel that that federal law was advantageous for Kentucky. Look, we don't like it here in Kentucky, so guess what? We're not going to follow it. That's all I did the very first time. Nullification crisis, don't forget that. South Carolina, for a while, nullified the tariff of 1828 and then 1832 because, well, for us here in South Carolina, that's not good. But then it goes, then we built on that. There has to be more to it than that, right? And so we built on that. So the states then nullified the law for a reason. I mean, the reason that I gave you, just because we here in South Carolina don't like it, I mean, come on, that's not going to work. So we're going to nullify this because we believe here in South Carolina, that that law is in conflict with the Constitution. I already did this. This should all be reviewed. And so, don't know about the rest of you states, but here in South Carolina, we respect the Constitution, the law of the land. So we're going to follow it here in South Carolina, which means we're not going to follow that particular law. There's a twist there, absolutely. Now, the problem with that is, the immediate problem is, that the states then are taking on a responsibility that's not theirs. Whoa, wait a minute, that sounds great. Thanks, South Carolina, for jumping in on that. But guess what? You know, there was a really neat commercial just recently. I haven't seen it lately. I laughed every time. It was the tattoo guy, the old hippie, doing the tattoo, and probably one of those insurance commercials. Stay in your lane, bro. Stay in your lane, bro. So that's what we say about South Carolina here. You know, stay in your lane. This is not the state's responsibility to determine constitutionality. That's the Supreme Court's job. So even though you can make it sound good, that's the Supreme Court's job. Also, it was justified as essential part of the way this government is operated to prevent a selfish majority of the states from dominating the minority. And I've said this time and time again, you know it, that if there's anything, any concept that we just embrace as Americans, it's majority rule. It's just there, where it's ingrained. And he used it just a few minutes ago when you decided to go to Taco Bell instead of McDonald's, the four of you, you know? But that doesn't mean that the majority is always right. That's the problem. So here come the states' rightsers then. We're going to fix that. We're going to take it upon ourselves to determine when the majority's wrong. Which, again, that's subjective, right? It's not objective. Okay. You know this as well, applied historically to numerous issues, and especially slavery. I mean, that's the paramount issue in American history that involves states' rights. And here we are. We're going to see where that goes here in the next few days. Examples. And then, here's the last little bit that we're going to add on to it, because it's coming, right? Secession was the lawful response to denial of states' rights by the federal government. And that's where South Carolina, again, South Carolina leads the way here in this secession of what's going to be 11 states that will cause the Civil War. I'll do that later on. So if the federal government isn't going to recognize this as a viable part of the way the government needs to operate, well, what's our alternative then? Well, it's secession. And that's what's going to come about here. I really think for the national exam, it would be good to have this. So that if there's any question at all, even just a set of multiple choice items, you've got that. Okay. And then we emerge from Manifest Destiny into the 1850s with slavery as the paramount issue. Remember, we're done with acquisition. Manifest Destiny Part 1. Done. And so next step, Manifest Destiny Part 2, is doing something with what we have acquired, and that's called development. And then that, you know, that's statehoods. I mean, there's a lot of parts of development, but one part is statehoods. And so, as you already know, any time prior to the Civil War, when there's that question of statehoods, then slavery, well, now it comes to as the top issue. So now, with so many states out here, that's why that issue comes to the top. Because within the next several years, there's going to be a lot of statehoods being considered. So here comes Henry Clay and decides we need this everlasting compromise. This'll be the magic touch. And it isn't, right? And that's not Henry Clay's fault. That's somebody else's fault. So as we enter the 1850s, there are several decades, I know I've mentioned this before, several decades, not necessarily decades, I shouldn't have confined it to just 10 years, periods of history that are just miserable, just the way it is, and the 1850s is one of them. You've really got to look hard in the 1850s to find any flowers. It's just a bunch of weeds. Then there's other decades where there's a lot of flowers. Era of good feelings, right? So in those times when it's just there's a bunch of weeds, can't seem to do anything right. Those are the times when responsible political leadership really shows. It would be nice to have some strong leadership at the national level to guide us through a crisis. I'm thinking of a little bit more recent example. All right. So let's see where it's at. Well, first place you think you start with is the presidents, right? Yeah, 1850s. Well, how about, let's see, I don't know. How about Jackson? Maybe he'll, no, he's not around. Polk could do something, no, he's not around. Well, let's see, who are we going to end up with? We enter the 1850s with the last Whig president. And you're trying to think of, now who's that? It doesn't matter, because none of the four Whig presidents were outstanding. I mean, no wonder you don't remember the name, unless I might have it up there. I don't. It's Millard Fillmore. Millard Fillmore came to the presidency upon the death of Zachary Taylor. And Millard Fillmore will be the last of the Whig presidents. He is not a strong president. Done in 52. Well, I mean, there's an election of 52. Well, who comes to the White House in 52? Franklin Pierce. And then in 56, James Buchanan. Those two, excuse me, are at the very, 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 very bottom of a performance chart for the presidents. At the very, very, very bottom. In fact, I've been listening to some podcasts lately over Christmas, and you know how I enjoy presidential history, and I've listened to a few podcasts about presidents in particular, and then as groups, and then rankings. And a couple surprises for me, I mean, than what I'm used to. But these two were not. These two are still at the very bottom. So let's put this in perspective then. At a time when, 1850s, the United States really, really, really needed some strong White House leadership, it wasn't there. We didn't need it in the era of good feelings. Didn't need it. I mean, Pierce and Buchanan, I don't know. They might not have been ranked so close to the bottom or at the bottom had they been president during the era of good feelings. You know, as long as they didn't screw things up, would have been okay. They both are unwilling to make decisions, especially Buchanan. So Buchanan was a president who believed that many of the decisions should be at the state level. And that's fine when it comes to certain topics, but when you have a national crisis, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Time and time and time and time again in history, it does not work. But that was Buchanan. So, we can't look in the White House. Well, how about Congress? Well, the great triumvirate, I've told you this, Clay, Calhoun, and Webster are all gone by 1852. I think the last one dies in 52. And Benton as well. He's the He's the footnote to the great triumvirate. And while there could be others to take their place, right? Well, there was one, Stephen Douglas. But he's just a newcomer. He isn't experienced like these four. And even if he was, well, here's one and here's four. So you've lost a lot more than what you've gained. So Congress instead, don't I have it on here? Yeah, here we go. Here's what Congress is going to be doing. You read about this. And so here's one member of Congress attacking another member of Congress. And so I'm thinking back to that Federalist era political cartoon that I've had up here a couple times. Really? This is an embarrassment to the United States. Congress is supposed to be a group of individuals, intelligent individuals who desire what is best for the United States. They recognize differences, but they are willing to work through those for the betterment of the United States. Really? This is one of those moments that is just, yes, it is embarrassing. It just, there's no other way to describe it. And then I just learned over the last couple weeks, there was actually another event right in 1850 or 51, 3, 4, 5 years prior to this, of a member of Congress actually pulling a gun on the rest of the session. Something like that. And it wasn't fired, and his colleagues stepped in and calmed him down, and I don't know, I think an apology later, but still, just for that to even happen, I mean, wow. Emotions were clearly out of hand. And then the cherry on the top here, if it's even needed, is that this congressman who levied the attack, Brooks from South Carolina, Butler of South Carolina, was reelected by South Carolina. Instead of South Carolina being embarrassed, really? This is one of our representatives is doing in Congress? You know, we got to act a little bit more appropriately than that. You apparently have a lot of energy, but let's use that energy in a positive fashion instead of that kind of an outlook. South Carolina, surprise, surprise, that it would be South Carolina, instead reelects him to Congress. Okay. So this is what's going on in Congress. So I guess we're not getting effectual leadership there. And that leaves then the Supreme Court, I've said before, can't rely on the Supreme Court for an extended amount of time to guide the country. Not like you can the White House and Congress, but still, maybe there's something there. Well, yeah, you can see that there was not. The Supreme Court was dominated by Southerners. And so it was used in the 1850s as a political mechanism to protect slavery. In case after case after case, the Supreme Court would render a ruling that would keep slavery entrenched and prohibit the national government from acting against it in any way, shape, or form. So that was the goal of the Supreme Court. So, you know, one side there.
Let me check my time here.
Okay. We get a few more minutes on that portion. So, in the 1850s, the United States is headed, wherever it's headed, it's just like, I know you've heard this cliche before, just a rudderless ship out in the ocean with the wind blowing. It's like wherever. It's going, but there's no sense of direction or purpose. And you just anticipate disaster. I mean, when you conjure that image of that rudderless ship in the ocean, you just, this isn't going to have a happy ending for whoever's on that ship. In the 1850s, say hello to a new political party, the Republican Party. So the Whig Party is done. The Whig Party, like so many entities in the 1850s, will split. It splits North and South, essentially. The conscience Whigs of the North, the cotton Whigs of the South. And so, the Whig Party's not going to get anything done. In fact, I just saw that question on a Jeopardy episode, a similar question about an entity that split prior to the 1850s, I think it was late 40s, 1848 or something. And, of course, there was a couple other things that was said there, but, it was the Methodist Church, split North and South. Now, all right. The Republican Party then is formed in the early 1850s, and it will replace the Whigs in our two-party political system. And, of course, it's still around today. Remember the political party right now, this moment, as anti-slavery. It is not abolitionist. You know, there's a difference. Okay. I didn't use one of the roller sheets. Sticky roller sheets on this, after it comes out of the dryer. And so I got fuzz going on. All right. Let's make sure we've got this. Now, this gets a little complicated if you're not tuned in. Officially, the Republican Party is anti-slavery, which means no expansion. So the Republican Party officially, I'll say that word five or six more times, then is willing to let slavery exist where it already exists. But no expansion. Done. So therefore, it is not abolitionist, officially. But now I'm trying to think. In the 1850s, if you're an abolitionist living in the United States, which party are you going to align with? The Republican Party? Or the Democratic Party, Party of the South? Well, you're going to align with the Republican Party. So the Republican Party was full of abolitionists. But that's not its official stance. What do you think that means to Southerners? It means nothing to Southerners. So Southerners politically see the Republican Party as the party of abolitionists. No. That's not our official stance. Our official stance is no expansion. Nah, come on. That's what you say today. Tomorrow, this weekend, it's going to be a little bit different. As we go on to period 6, you will remember the Republican Party as the party that favors free land to settlers in the West. So the Republican Party is the party of expansion, big time. And also, since it's the party of the North, supported manufacturing interests, protective tariff. Yeah, that's not a new concept to you. So this would be the past, although the Republican Party isn't the past, but it's the Party of the North. And this would be the future, that's where we're headed. And then this is for the right now. The Republican Party's first candidate in 1856 was Fremont. I don't even think you need to know that. That's why I don't have it up here. John Fremont, if you remember him from something else in Garrity or Brinkley, you remember Fremont as an explorer, Western explorer, but also a commander of American troops during the Mexican War. And this is Buchanan. So Buchanan wins this election. In 1860, the Republican Party enters the White House. So immediate success for the Republican Party. That's not so much due to the party machinery. Oh, that's brilliant. Wow, immediate success. How'd you guys do that? Well, in this case, it's due to the big issue that's going on, right? Slavery. The question of slavery. So from this moment on, until further notice, you will identify the Republican Party as the Party of the North, the Democratic Party as the Party of the South. At this moment, like no other moment in history, before or after, a strong geographical alignment with a political party. So much so that Northerner and Republican are practically synonymous. And Southerner and Democrat are practically synonymous. I don't want to go too far. I didn't say they are. But like no other time in history. And then that's going to change. I mean, it's not like that now, right? It's kind of the opposite. Let's see. The Civil War ends in 65. So, I don't know. By the election of 72 or 76, that's probably changed. No. It's going to stay that way for a long, long time into the new century, beyond 1900. So that's what I say, until further notice. And that notice isn't coming later this week. That notice is coming first week in March or something like that. You will identify the Republican Party with the North, the Democratic Party with the South. Okay. Time to start and stop. Ooh.